excuse me, of the House Education Policy Committee, and there is a quorum present. All right, our first order of business will be approving the minutes. Representative Lee, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Madam Chair, I've had a chance to review the minutes, and I move to approve the minutes.
All right, any discussions of the minutes this afternoon? All right, hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from, let me get the date, Tuesday, January 31st, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. Thank you, committee. All right, so to begin this meeting, we are again going to do a short presentation, and we're going to have, pleased to have members of our school board association. And what we asked them to talk about, because it's relevant to the bill that we'll be hearing this afternoon, is flexibility that local districts need in scheduling and creating opportunities and innovations for students to better meet every student's need. So we thought a little bit of background information about, you know, kind of what exists right now, what the needs are, what the barriers are, and then perhaps some ideas on things that we can look at as a committee. And I think the bill that we're going to hear today has a lot of interest as something that we can work with in the future. So with that, I would like to ask our first testifier to come over and start our presentation. And we have Lucy Payne. And if you, when you're comfortable and ready to remember, unlike I did, remember the microphone and start with that. Introduce yourself for the record and please proceed.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Lucy Payne. I'm joined today with two of my colleagues who are online. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us come speak to you today on educational options and flexibilities for student learning. I'm Dr. Lucy Payne, a member of the Matamidi High School Board and a faculty member in teacher preparation at the University of St. Thomas. With me today online are Jason Berg, Superintendent of Farmington Public Schools, and Barb Dufferin, Superintendent of Matamidi High Public Schools. We have been collaborating and thinking with Minnesota School Boards Association, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and many others for the past few years on what flexibility in our schools could look like and how it could benefit student learning. To start with, Ms. Dufferin will talk about concrete examples that we're thinking of.
Thank you.
Ms. Dufferin, if you would introduce yourself again for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Barb Dufferin, and I'm the superintendent of Matamidi Public Schools. And today you will be hearing testimony regarding House File 613, allowing high school students to earn credit while employed with healthcare providers. The bill represents a recognition that we need to change the way we prepare high school students for college and career. It is clear the needs of our economy and society have evolved since the design of the factory model of schooling that we're all familiar with. Nationally, employers are expressing how difficult it is to find applicants with important skills like critical thinking or communication. Preparing students to confidently pursue post-secondary college and career opportunities requires a more responsive, student-centered approach where learning is validated beyond the school day and the classroom walls. So, for example, what if all high school students had the opportunity for a credit-bearing internship or job in an area of interest? May even be working alongside one of you. Certainly your work would be enhanced given the opportunity for student voice and perspective, and certainly our students would benefit from a deeper understanding of the complexity of civic work. And if students were deeply engaged with government and policy, could this opportunity be used to let them earn credit toward their social studies graduation requirements? Or might it assist the student in connecting their learning to other interests that drive their post-secondary planning? Our trained educators know how best to connect standards with these real-world experiences. So we envision high school credit-bearing learning experiences where students, teachers, and business, civic, or service leaders partner intentionally by design. Some schools across the state are working with students to design experiences of this nature, where students dive deep into an area of interest or passion with a faculty advisor. But these experiences often require going through a complicated waiver process, or a willing instructor to add to their course load, or a district that is able to budget for an unfunded experience. Until barriers like this are overcome, their growth will continue to be limited. I want to share two examples of what this can look like, as well as the inherent challenges to making them a reality. So for years, Farmington High School has offered a 0 hour to students who want to pursue advanced music studies while maintaining a rigorous course load. 0 hour begins at 7 a.m. before the official start of the school day. And while students earn credit for their 0 hour courses, the district cannot generate funding for these courses because the classes are outside the defined school day. At Montemidi, we have an extracurricular activity of 15 to 20 high school students, our MAPS team, where students research and develop a model of a specific protein to present at an undergraduate level International Experimental Biology Conference. Many of our former MAPS students have gone on to science or medical fields and have cited the MAPS experience as invaluable to them in their college coursework. The level of rigor required to research, develop, and present the protein model may surpass other credit-bearing opportunities, but without a scheduled course period during the defined school day, a district cannot generate revenue to fund the instructional materials or the instructor. Currently, the students fundraise throughout the year to participate in this experience. And now I'm going to hand this back to Dr. Lucy Payne to talk about why we really want to go, what is our purpose to flexibility?
Dr. Payne, thank you. Why are options and flexibility important in education? We know that every learner's needs and strengths are unique. We know engagement and learning is more important than seat time. We know teachers care deeply about student achievement and success, and we know career and college readiness is our desired outcome. As Superintendent Dufferin shared, we know that our current system is failing to prepare too many of our young people for what comes next. Our community in Matamidi is asking for flexibility to help us meet our students' needs. Through our strategic planning process created by community members, teachers, and students, we've identified our secondary schedule as a barrier. As we work to improve our schedule, we have reviewed the U.S. News, highly ranked schools of a similar size, and found they all had schedules with a great deal of flexibility. More flexibility built into the system would allow time for students to get support when they need it, before they fail, and for enrichment to be available to all our students so they know we are working to meet their individual needs. The draft high school schedule from our strategic plan also works for flexibility in the length of the class period so teachers can extend class when needed for deeper learning, more engaged learning, like science experiments or simulations. I'm excited for this potential and positive impact of this new schedule, but we can't have this schedule without more flexibility. We know every student comes to school with their own unique learning needs and passions. We know strong learner engagement leads to deep thinking. Barb Dufferin just shared a few examples of learning passions that support the Minnesota academic standards and prepare students for career in college. These examples are integrated, engaged learning experiences embedded in the real-world context. Students are seeking out opportunities and experiences that align with their interests. When talking with students at our high school, at our academic awards breakfast, they all spoke about their learning passions and how they're using them outside of the traditional school day. Having the flexibility to offer different types of experiences leads to students who are able to apply learning to new and novel situations. This type of critical thinking is an important skill in the workplace. We know teacher retention is a challenge. In a report from the Educator Policy Innovation Center, it was stated, Minnesota teachers love what they do. They articulate and demonstrate that commitment over and over again. But Minnesota's education policies have created a profession that fewer and fewer young professionals will ever consider, and more current teachers will abandon before completing their first few years. One important retention strategy they share is the need for increased support for teacher agency, which means granting autonomy to teachers as they respond to student needs and involving teachers in school-wide decision-making process. Teachers and schools need options and flexibility for this to happen. The rigidity of our system doesn't allow our teachers to do what's best for student learning and growth because we know that students learn differently from one another and often at different paces. The governor's budget proposal includes money in one-time grants to reimagine secondary school experiences.
Funding like this is critical for helping schools and districts create innovative learning opportunities. Those grants will only reach their true potential if the state provides the flexibility to districts to explore innovations in seat time and teacher agency. Now, Mr. Berg will talk some about how we can get there.
Mr. Berg.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself.
Sorry. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. My name is Jason Berg, and as shared previously, I am the superintendent of Farmington Area Public Schools. Ms. Dufferin and Dr. Payne shared some possibilities of where we'd like to go and why we need to go there. So now the obvious question becomes, how do we get there? School districts need the conditions set so that any learner can receive credit and a school can receive funding for learning that takes place anywhere, anytime. Districts can make some of this happen now, but either do not generate funding or are not able to take a system-wide approach to designing these experiences through the current independent study process. We need to think differently about learning design. Districts need increased flexibility and agility to meet today's workforce needs and tomorrow's unknowns. One approach could be to redefine how districts account for the required instructional hours that are laid out in Minnesota Statute 120A.41. Currently, instructional hours are determined by attendance or seat time during the designated school day, according to the MARS data element booklet that all districts received. We know that seat time is not an indicator of engagement or learning. It is an efficient way of accounting. What if we counted instructional hours as hours of educational services not bound by the school day or the school calendar? We're not asking to change the day or the hour requirements, but extend the flexibility of how to meet those requirements. Over the previous two legislative sessions, there have been bills brought to this committee addressing the current limiting definition of instructional hours. I would strongly encourage this committee to revisit some of that language. And just for context, there are currently at least 13 other states that have codified policies that allow districts to implement alternative instructional time models. A second opportunity would be to revisit the concepts of innovation zone. An innovation zone designation would be an opportunity for districts that choose to begin to think differently about learning design. It allows districts to continue to improve what has worked for their learning while simultaneously investigating different ways to serve each learner excellently. It allows districts to step away from what we have always done. If we truly want to impact positive change, we need to provide staff time to think differently. I was fortunate enough to be part of the original Innovation Zone in 2012, which was a partnership between Farmington and Spring Lake Park, and saw the positive impact it had on the experiences of our learners. Revisiting the Innovation Zone concept, as very little has been accepted through the inception, would allow districts to develop individual plans to better support each learner in their district and work in partnership with MDE to remove barriers to a better design of learning. There are states that have extended these types of opportunities for all districts. Our neighbors to the west, for example, North Dakota, have authorized a state waiver option developed to develop innovative education programs back in 2017. Currently, Minnesota is one of six states with no waiver opportunity for its school districts. We know things as redefining instructional minutes and waivers or innovation zones are happening. North Dakota is one example, but we can look to Utah, Arizona, Kentucky, South Carolina, and Washington to name a few. The pandemic amplified the design flaws of our current school system. Through redesign options and flexibility, we can increase engagement, learner agency, and eliminate persistent inequities. Learners no longer want or should just spend time sitting in a class learning about the same thing at the same time, at the same pace. This would empower qualified teachers to become a designer and a coach who can give support while keeping students engaged, stimulated, and connected in much more meaningful ways.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Any concluding remarks, Dr. Payne?
Madam Chair, we want to save a couple of minutes at the end if there are questions for us. If not, that's the end of our remarks.
All right. So open for questions and discussion. at this point? Yes. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for this presentation. And Dr. Payne is my maiden name, so glad to meet a fellow. But you're speaking my language right here. This is something that's really exciting. As a teacher for almost 20 years, I had struggled within the confines of the current system that we have. I did want to say that I wanted to know, my one question is, and we'll probably be asking this as well with the other bill, is currently in statute on 124D.085, it does allow for experiential and applied learning opportunities through, oh goodness, why did it all of a sudden change where I wanted it to be? Through work-based schools, place-based learning, project-based learning. So can we already implement something like this through this statute that's already in place?
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Payne, if this is, if we can look to you for understanding the answer to this, but also there may be other people in the room too that can also provide insight too, if this is, you know, not a little bit outside your scope of expertise. But Dr. Payne, I will give you the first shot at that one.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. This is not my area of intense work as a school board member. I watch my governing boundaries very carefully, as my superintendent will share with you. So I'd like to turn this over to either Mr. Berg or Ms. Dufferin.
Right. And so Mr. Berg or Ms. Dufferin, either one of you can pop in if you would like, or you can remain silent, and we'll keep, we'll go around the room.
I'll give Ms. Dufferin the first shot.
And okay. Ms. Dufferin, you're the winner.
Okay. So yes, thank you. There are abilities to do some of the things that we're talking about. And I think what we want to be clear about is that, again, we are doing some of these things that we talked about already, but with every opportunity, it's a one-off. It's one thing that we can do if we can find the right teacher or if we can fit it into the schedule. What we're asking for is increased flexibility so that we can design these experiences district-wide for every student as they appear. So some of what we've talked about can be done through experiential learning, independent study. Actually Superintendent Berg can speak to, and it's hard to speak to this a little bit, but the just-in-time learning and how we discovered that if we don't have students, why don't you talk a little bit about what happens with extended learning and targeted services?
I actually have two things. High School.
And I'm going to, just to identify you to make sure that we keep straight who our speakers are. So Mr. Berg, I believe then the question goes to you.
Yeah, it's Jason Berg again, sorry. We do have workforce and we do have mentorship at Farmington High School. I think what we're asking for is to be, we do it within the school day, right? We have a dedicated class, like fifth hour, that's work-based, right? It's limiting when you try to say that it has to take place within our five period day. Can we do it? Yes, we can. Is it as robust as experience if it was extended beyond our 250 start or if it was on Saturday? Most certainly it would be. So I think there are these things that we can do, but if we truly want our learners to get the full impact of these experiences, we have to look beyond the traditional, seven period day, six period day, and the traditional school calendar. And I think that's the real crux of it, is to get a true intern experience. Can you do that just 1 hour a day for a semester, or does it need to be looked at differently? So that would be my response to the first question. And then in terms of some of the other parts, right, just in time learning. So the way that a targeted service, especially at the secondary, is generated is we wait until our learners fail, right? And then once they fail a class, we can put them into targeted services or credit recovery. They will begin to generate additional revenue because that takes place outside the school day. Another area of flexibility would be to look at how do we take potentially that those targeted services dollars and use them during the school day to keep kids from failing, right? I mean, it's the deficit model of we're going to wait and then we're going to provide additional assistance instead of maybe taking some of those resources we'd be able to tap into a little later and use them more proactively to ensure that it never happens.
Thank you, Mr. Berg.
Just a quick follow-up.
And a follow-up from Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much. I think we'll have to, the amount of things that I really want to do, I really want to talk about, we'll have to do offline. And Dr. Payne, I'd love to connect with you later. But the final question that I'd ask as a response to our wonderful superintendents and workers here is, who told you that you couldn't do it outside of the traditional day? Where in statute or who told you that you couldn't do some of these things for credit outside of the traditional day?
So it, right?
And that's okay. So now we're, yes, thank you, Mr. Berg, for coming back on to answer that question from Representative Mueller. Thank you.
I'm really bad at this. I apologize.
No, you're doing awesome because you're there and you are ready and we appreciate that.
Well, right. So there's two things going on here. There's credit, right? And we can provide credit outside the school day. That's not the issue, but it's the funding that would flow with it, right? So every district has a MARS manual. The MARS manual defines for districts what the school year is, what the school day is, how instructional minutes need to be accounted for. And if it falls outside of that, you're not going to generate the funding. And so a really simple example that Ms. Dufferin shared is 0 hour at Farmington. We have actually more than one class. We have multiple classes that happen before our school day starts. We have Jazz Band 1, Jazz Band 2. We have Algebra 2. We have a couple other math classes. We have a health class. Those kids sitting in those classes do not, we can give them credit for it. That's not the issue. They do not generate any revenue because that takes place outside our defined school day. So even though those kids are taking we have a 5-period day, even though those kids are still going to take at least 5 and probably 6 class periods, I mean, we're not asking to get generated for 6 class periods, but we, for some kids, they take 0 hour and then 1, 2, 3, and 4. We only get 4/5 of the funding form because they're not in a 5th hour and they might leave early to go work or do something else. So there's two parts to this. It's the credit part and then it's the funding part. And then the funding drives how you organize it because you have to pay people to do these things. And so, we just fund that out of our general fund, really, is what happens. So hopefully that answers. It's not so much telling you can't, it's just how the system is designed.
Mm-hmm. And appreciate the answer. And I'm going to we know that this is and obviously something that we can, because what we're talking about now, there's not a specific bill for. But we do have a bill coming up that addresses part of it. But, you know, interesting to bring forward this information and think about what our opportunities are to support flexibly and different learning experiences. So I'm going to go to Representative Joaquin for the next question or comment, and then we'll turn to an actual bill that we're thinking concretely about. Is this something that we want to do and adapt as a policy? Representative Joaquin.
Actually, thank you, Madam Chair. It was just a quick question. For Superintendent Berg, I have toured the Farmington model and they are doing great things down there, but I forgot, wanted to ask you too, when you talk about that 0 day, how are you dealing with transportation? Because we know that is a big equity piece. So wondering how they handle that and then we can move on, but I just wanted to know.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. If you can come back and address the transportation issue as related to all of this.
Yep, so that is, again, because we don't generate any funding for that, that is all student provided.
Okay, all right. And that, yes, we'll mark that and note that, and not everyone has equal access to transportation, so there is some inequality and inequity if that's how it has to happen in a school. So great information. Appreciate our presentation. Thank you for being with us today. And I'm assuming that, you know, people can follow up with specific questions and, further discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Now we welcome back to the committee Representative Jess Hansen, who has an interesting and a great bill to bring before us today. And I know that there's lots of support and a lot of interested parties in hearing about this. All right. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Obviously, Representative Hansen is not a member of this committee, so Representative Berg, would you please make the motion to move House File 613 before us as a committee to be laid over for further consideration?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House File 613 to be before us in the committee and be laid over.
All right, and hang on, because we also have an amendment to 613, all right, that will need to be moved too. So thank you for bringing 613, Representative Hansen, and I believe you do have an amendment that you would like to be adopted before we begin our discussion.
Yes, Chair, I do have an amendment just to get the bill in the state that I would like. In having conversations with a number of different caring facilities around the state and a number of different advocates, we would like to expand this, and so this amendment does that.
All right. And so, Representative Berg, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Berg. I think Representative Hansen gave a brief overview of it, and basically this is the way she would like the bill to be considered today. So all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. Well, now we have the House File 613 as amended. So, Representative Hansen, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Jess Hansen. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm excited to present to you House File 613 today. Thanks for giving me the time to present this so quickly as well. This is a pretty simple bill that will produce positive outcomes in the healthcare fields where we provide care to vulnerable Minnesotans. This bill is modeled after a program in Washington State that empowers students to receive elective credits for gaining real-world experiences for being in the workforce. And with this bill, high school students who decide to work in long-term care, disability services, or within a hospital or clinic setting can earn their wages and earn elective credits towards graduation. Students decide to work for a variety of reasons, whether it's to help support themselves or their families, to save for a car or college, or to start a business, or to have money for those new sneakers, or just to blow at the mall. Whatever the reason, this bill provides elective credits for students who choose to work in healthcare industries with seniors, people with disabilities, and more. As many of you know, the long-term care and home and community-based service industries are struggling to retain an adequate workforce. We've all heard about this in a number of different committees. The field is on the verge of collapse in several areas because of this shortage of workers, and it's exacerbated by the trend of low wages in many of these arenas. The services that many of these facilities offer are often based on payment models that are dictated by state statute or by insurance company contracts. So the companies can't simply raise their costs to pay their workers more without legislative action or more macro action. So needless to say, it is critical that we expand the opportunities for more people to find their passions in caring careers as the legislature does our part to fix some of the root causes and systemic issues. Working in the helping fields offers social benefits for both the students and the people that they serve. We know 43% of seniors experience loneliness, and this can lead to an increased risk of declining health or early death. Experts suggest that getting youth and seniors together regularly has benefits for both age groups. Anecdotally, I'm sure we can all probably agree that the knowledge sharing between generations is invaluable. We all know that youth can learn so much from their elders and vice versa. Elders share historical experiences, model valuable life skills, and they have great advice and pointers for success. Students' inherent energy and youthful perspectives about culture and innovation can expand experiences and tools for elders too. And social company can be especially important for both of those groups of people, especially those experiencing the pain of loneliness. We also know that teaching youth to share and accept each other's differences is a part of building an inclusive culture that shields people with disabilities from bullying and overall othering. Numerous studies have documented that people with visible and invisible disabilities are at a greater risk of experiencing bullying than their peers, as you've heard me discuss in this committee before. Educating youth about disability and inclusion overall protects people from bullying and encourages a culture of empathy and kindness. Being immersed in a caring profession aids in the development of honorable morals and ethics that make the world a better place for more people. As the workforce for people with disabilities continues to dwindle, it's critical that we empower more people to choose careers, whether they be long-term or temporary, in these service delivery models so that people with disabilities and more can continue to receive the services that we as a state have promised to deliver with care and compassion. This proposal partners well with the growing number of pathways programs that we've heard about, it sounds like you've heard about in this committee too, and school districts like mine in ISD 191 that we offer to our students. And this can provide additional incentives for youth to participate in the programs. This bill both promotes a youth's ability to learn and grow while partnering with the industries in their communities that are providing these critical and vital services to people experiencing a variety of vulnerabilities. You'll see that there's letters of support from the Minnesota Hospitals Association, the Long-Term Care Imperative, ARM, Best Life Alliance, and more that are supporting this work. If you've heard me speak in other committees, you've known that I've been working to find ways to repair the gaps in these workforce shortages by offering a variety of options in our higher education committee, whether that be expanding grants, offering free or reduced college for people in caring professions, and more. So this is one step of many that we in the legislature should take to make sure that we're repairing some of those systemic issues that I mentioned. And with that, I would turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you. Linda Dreesen,
yes.
Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is Linda Dreesen, and I'm the Executive Director of Bear Creek Services, which is a nonprofit organization in Rochester that supports individuals with developmental disabilities and brain injury in residential settings, group homes. Most of you will know what I'm talking about when I talk about group homes and the challenges that we are experiencing finding employees. Currently, we support approximately 100 individuals in our group homes and in community living settings, and we currently employ about 115 employees. We could easily employ 130 employees. None of those employees currently is a high school student. What I wanted to let you know is for the last 2 years, I've been working with other providers in the Rochester area, 7 to be exact, to try to come together to work cooperatively with the Rochester Public School District to build a pathway for high school students to become direct support professionals and then work their way into whatever career area they wish to go. Unfortunately, we have struggled with meeting up with the Rochester Public School District for a variety of reasons, change in superintendent and just leadership change and different things. But nonetheless, we have struggled, but we've worked hard to try to work cooperatively with the school district. Beyond helping us find employees, which we desperately need, I see this pipeline as an opportunity for high school students to learn so much more than just supporting people with disabilities. Yes, there's the healthcare aspect of that. There's the toileting. There's the feeding. There's helping people take their medication. But there's budgeting and shopping and the whole gamut, life skills of teaching people with disabilities how to be part of their community. But for the most part, I believe high school students learn some of the things that were already mentioned: empathy, problem solving, de-escalation skills. We all know that there's more room for all of us to be able to bring a difficult situation down, and that can be utilized in a whole lot of career areas. I just want you to know a little bit about myself. I was born into the disability field. I have a sister who has a developmental disability, but I did not choose this career. I have a master's degree in counseling and psychological services, and I was going to work with student athletes. When I was in college and graduate school, I could not find a job but in disability support services because of the time when I was looking for a job. The thing about disability supports, there are very few people who go, gee, I want to support people with disabilities for a career. What happens is you get into the field and you find out you love it, and then you can't leave it because you believe so deeply in what it is that you're doing and changing the lives of people with disabilities. We know that if we can get high school students to start in this career, there's a good chance that they will stay. And they can be like me, where you start as a direct support professional, which is what I did with my master's degree, and work your way up to being an executive director or a lawyer or a doctor or a nurse or a council person or, you know, congressman, congresswoman. So I hope you will consider the bill, and yeah, that's my story.
Great. Thank you. Any further words before we go to member discussion and questions?
No, thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. So I'll go to Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for this bill.
You're welcome.
I think one of the things I want to highlight is the creativeness of the overlap of what we hear at the table. So I sit in Human Services, where we talk deeply about the shortage in this area, and we all agree that we need to find really creative ways to fill these spots. I mean, down to the point that we know that we even need more people to move to Minnesota just to fill these areas, that providing an opportunity for our high school students to get into potential long-term careers, that we are in a massive crisis right now, I think is a really innovative way for us to look at solutions that overlap generations. Culturally, we've really believed and have seen value in our elders partnering with our next generations, right? Like, this is where our stories are. This is where our history is. This is where, you know, we're oral storytelling, but also we know that our elders are really lonely. And it's feeding them this livelihood and support, and often they just feel forgotten or left over. And so this is really, I love this. I love this from a breaking down the silos in areas. We can't be in one space saying we have this massive work shortage, and like, how are we going to fix it? Well, here's the absolute solution. So I appreciate the way that you do this. I appreciate the way that you wrap around all of the needs that Minnesota needs moving forward, and then blending the cultural pieces and generational pieces to it. So I appreciate the work and absolutely support this moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you so much. Yes, Representative Keeler. I've been saying it to my classroom for the last 10 years. This is something that I've been talking about forever. And so I love this. Here, I do have a couple of questions, though. First of all, why would this here say the you can earn up to 2 elective credits, first of all? Elective, we know if we listened to the presentation, all of us, we listened to the presentation yesterday. Our students are only allowed so many electives, and that's often for like FFA or band or choir or something like that. Could this not fulfill a healthcare requirement or I don't know. I'm just trying to think creative as well, so that as we were listening to the flexibility option just here, why is this not something that we could use that instead of coveted elective credits?
All right, and we might have a new testifier to address that question, and then would you please identify yourself for the record, and
absolutely, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair. This is Tara Erickson. She's here for technical assistance with me, so thank you for allowing her to join me, and thank you, Representative Mueller. I'm going to defer to her. She has helped craft this and found the model policy in Washington, and so I just want to give credit where credit is due and allow her to answer that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the first, my name is Tara Erickson. It's the first time I have been before the Education Committee in 23 years. So don't ask me anything about education. Except for this one.
Yes,
So Representative Mueller, what I will tell you is that because Washington State had already laid out this program, and I was in Seattle and I read the Seattle Times, and I was like, oh my gosh, I represent disability service providers, and Hennepin County Medical Center. We have such a workforce shortage everywhere. So what I did is I contacted them, and they said that they had talked to a number of different departments and thought about 350 hours for one credit seemed like a good, a good route, and they could earn up to 2. The reason for them is that apparently they have less elective credits to earn than Minnesota children do. And so I just wanted to try and keep it simple and thought that this could just be an incentive program, and we just mimicked it after Washington State. Mm-hmm. Open to any advice that you guys have.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Hansen.
And I would add to that, too. I mean, this committee is where the brains are at, so let's be real. If there's changes that we think would fit better or things that we think we could expand this further, whether it is for a specific one, maybe it's an either-or, I'm entirely open to that. The goal of this is to make sure that we are providing very clear pathways for people to get into caring professions, not just because, I mean, the workforce thing comes up a lot. We know that's an issue. But let's be honest, we all know that that loved one we have that's in a setting like that, whether it's in a hospital temporarily or in long-term care, that one person that makes their day makes it easier for us to share smiles with them, to have a meal and laugh together with. And so these are just such critical roles. And those folks go home, and I think we all deserve to love our job, you know? And so I think just providing that would be my way too long of an answer for you, Representative Mueller.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. And I was just looking at the amendment. Let me just do a quick correction. This would actually take 4 elective credits, which, again, that's a pretty big number. I know in the past we've heard other things that when we require extra classes, we've had people come and say, please don't do that because it takes away our electives. So, you know, I've also heard other testimony in the past where I've asked where someone has offered an EMT course as an elective, and I asked why it couldn't be a science credit or a health credit, and the testifier said MDE does not have the credibility or credit equivalency, and so maybe that's something we should take up with MDE to see how that goes. My only other question, thank you, Madam Chair, is there isn't in this language any thing that says how a student would be approved for this, meaning do they have to pass a background check? What kind of training do they have to do? And I just, you know, we've heard of some horrible things that have happened in facilities. And I said I support this, and I think this is a good thing. I just want to make sure we're getting good people in there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Mueller, this is exactly why we're bringing it forward now, because and laying it over, you know, with the understanding that if we're bringing it forward again, you know, the idea is that it's open to amendment and improvement, and that's why we have committees.
Yes.
Okay. All right, and we're going to turn this over to Ms. Erickson again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I believe that, well, first off, for the credits, it is up to 2 credits per year, so it would be 4 over the 2 years. What was the second question about?
Training.
Sorry. So the training is both long-term care and HCBS providers. They have their own training requirements that we have to have in order for certification or licensing from our regulatory bodies. And so we all have to do that certification anyway. We would never, these providers would not be having people go out on, you know, go out and provide care without going through our training. And we have to legally do the background checks. So they would have that. They're a little backed up right now from here, but that is what's going on. So they would all have background checks.
All right. So I'm taking then, you know, as part of this, you have to be employed, and then you have to fulfill the requirements for that employment, which would include a background check and training. And we're running up against our deadline for hearing this particular bill, and I know that it seems that Representative Mueller would would you'd like to do another follow-up question, and I believe also that Representative Bennett would like a comment, and Representative Bakeberg.
I can.
If it's all right, further discussions offline. I think if that's all right with Representative Bakeberg, one more from Representative Keeler, and then Representative Bennett, if you would. I'm also like a question here or a comment. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I do want to yield the fact that I already spoke once, and so I don't want to take up too much time, so I would be willing to yield my time if that... Okay. I just want to make a statement around the background check piece of it, that is another massive barrier that we're having, and we see it in our substitute licensing, daycares, everything. You know, we have a community that's the fastest growing community outside of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and our licensing is through a contract that has now been able to say, nah, we're good. We just don't want to do background checks in Moorhead. And so I just want to make sure that as we move forward with getting more people into this, that is another massive issue that I think we all need to make sure that we're very, very aware of, especially for greater Minnesota, because in the state contract, it says if we're going to do any contracts with individuals who provide background checks, it has to be within 39 miles of the location in which you're going to do business, and we know that's not happening. Right. So I just want to make sure that that's on record somewhere else, that as we do this and we want to make sure we get people into the pathways in these jobs, there is a massive breakdown at that background check level. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. And my question got answered by the superintendent, but I have a comment. And my question was, is this not already allowed in law? And basically he said it is. And we have a statute in Minnesota that would allow us to give credit for this kind of thing. But I guess the comment that I have is that, and first of all, I love this bill, and I think it's great, and we should be doing more of it. And I love nursing homes and group homes, so like combine those together, it's wonderful. And perhaps this is just clarifying for districts that they are able to do this, mm-hmm. which we do often in law. But I would ask you to consider one thing as you move forward with this, because this might be unintentionally giving districts the thought that they can only do this for nursing homes and group homes. When they can, in Minnesota, do this, they could do this for childcare, for the trades, for all these things. And I wouldn't want them to think that they need special permission for each field. And so might you consider in your bill actually widening this up into other areas? I could see childcare as a perfect thing too, and get those generations together like Representative Keeler was speaking about. So great bill, but consider widening it, and also so we don't unintentionally make schools think they can't do anything but this. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Bennett, and I know that we very much appreciated the opportunity to hear the bill for the first time, and looking forward to further discussions and other ways of improving. And if you're open to I think that there's more questions that we had and more mm-hmm. comments that we'd like to make in the future too. But we will lay it over for now. And so Representative Byrd renews her motion to lay over House File 613. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you, committee.
And I'll even go like that. Lay it over. All right. So next up, next up is Representative Chair Yu Akeem, and we have House File 620.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. And if you please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. And we'll make, I guess we'll start by making the motion to bring House File 620. So Chair Yu Akeem, would you like to move 620 to be before us, to be re-referred to the Committee on Education and Finance?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 620 before the Education Committee.
All right. And please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Representative Cheryl Yu Akeem, and I'm here today, Madam Chair and members, to present House File 620. Thank you for letting me come in and do that. As an educator, as an education support professional, this bill is near and dear to my heart. It requires that education support professionals, ESPs, also known as paraprofessionals, are given 16 hours of paid professional development or training per year. The bill proposes an appropriation to pay for this. As the bill moves on to Ed Finance, we will fill in the blank appropriation lines. The bill also includes requirements that those who work with individual students with disabilities must be given time to review a student's IEP and or time to collaborate with the student's teacher regarding the plan before they work with that student. This communication between teacher and paraprofessional who are working with students is so very important. It is especially important for paras who are working with students with special needs. The training and communication helps a para to know how best to work with that student, what triggers the student may have, what works to calm or motivate them, and what vulnerabilities they might have. Some of these training requirements are already happening in our schools, but this bill would not only make sure the training is happening, it would provide funding for the schools to enable them to do that training. In the weeks since we've started session here, we've heard more and more about the needs our students have, especially around mental health. That makes this training in the presence of qualified support staff in our classrooms even more important in meeting the needs of our students. This last interim, I once again worked in our schools as a substitute paraprofessional. In previous years, I've worked as a full-time para during the interim with kindergartners with special needs in a level 3 program, EBD, DCD program at Aquila and St. Louis Park. I've also worked as a para in our early childhood settings and at the high school level. Over the years, I've seen just how effective professional training can be. I've also seen what happens when training's not available. I've started after the school year at one time and experienced having to do the training on my own time that was required. That happened to me when I first started at Aquila a few years back. Even though I had started at the beginning of the school year at Aquila, it was after some of the training time had been provided. So I had about 5+ hours of online modules dealing with health and safety that had to be viewed on my own time. I was happy to do it, but our educational support professionals deserve to get paid for their time when they're training to do their jobs. Finding those funds can be even harder than finding the time. With the appropriation, the bill would provide our schools some relief. St. Louis Park is not alone in trying to find money for training. Many districts are forced to pick and choose what they can afford versus training their paras as fully functioning team members that could do much more to serve our students. While this is my story, I know that it's not a unique one. You will now hear from educational support professionals with firsthand experience and who are doing incredible work in our schools every day. I also want to note that you have a letter from the Coalition for Children with Disabilities in your packet that is a letter of support. So, Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to turn this over to our testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Chair Joachim. I have first on my list Mr. Bill Schwant. And when you're settled in, you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is William Schwant. I am the president of the Bloomington Federation of Paraprofessionals. And more importantly, I am a special ed paraprofessional. I work with students in multi-categorical programs at Poplar Bridge Elementary in Bloomington. I'm here to speak today about the need for funding to provide paraprofessionals across the state with meaningful professional development. Currently, there is a statute, which is statute 125A.08, section C, part 1 and 2, states that each school board shall ensure that the district provides professional development opportunities for paraprofessionals, but that's not occurring. This is part of a statute that basically equates to an unfunded mandate. In my own district, we're lucky to receive 1 6-hour day of professional development before the beginning of the school year. And during that day, we're treated to such scintillating topics as mandated reporting, maltreatment of minors, data privacy, bloodborne pathogens, just to name a few. While important in their own right, none of these topics address the needs of the students we're working with. And as also is stated in the previously stated statute does not allow paraprofessionals to increase their knowledge and their abilities to work with the children which they are assigned. I've talked with a number of ESP leaders from around the state, and this is not a problem exclusive to Bloomington. This is happening across our state. Paraprofessionals come from many walks of life. Many have little or no experience in working with students receiving special education services prior to starting, and their only reference to what happens in school is either their own personal educational experience or that which they experience through their own children. I can say education looks very different from when I was a public school student. For new paraprofessionals who are hired prior to the start of the school year, they are afforded a little bit of an opportunity to learn about the students they'll be working with before those students begin coming on a daily basis. But those people that are hired after the school year starts are typically cast right into the fire, assigned to a student, and left to fend for themselves. Without professional development upon employment and annual opportunities, these paraprofessionals may never develop the skills and understanding necessary to make a positive impact on a student's education and ultimately their lives. One of the outcomes of the COVID pandemic is that paraprofessionals are an essential part of the education environment, and it's even more so for students receiving special education services. Investment in professional development for paraprofessionals is not only an investment in paraprofessionals, it's an investment in students. I will close with this thought. Psychologist Abraham Maslow is credited with a concept called Maslow's hammer. The concept revolves around the quote that if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Students, especially those in special education, need paraprofessionals with a full tool chest to address their needs and allow them to succeed. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Tracy Detloff, and I believe that would be on remote. So, Ms. Detloff, if you can come on, identify yourself, and please proceed.
Hi, thank you for having me today. My name is Tracy Detloff. 2 years I was a paraprofessional, and for the last 18 years a special ed teacher. This year, currently our district QCOM coordinator with New London Spicer School District. Education is changing, but one thing remains certain. Schools need to attract and retain highly qualified education support professionals. ESPs have a vital role in our district. They are caring for our most challenging students, yet they are often the least paid and least trained people in our school community. Paraprofessionals are critical to providing the best supportive educational environments for our students, yet what kind of an environment are we providing for them? As a 20-year teacher, I could not do my job without utilizing the talents of my special education staff. I see firsthand how my room could not function without the many support staff it takes to run a special education department. So how can we maximize the talents of our paraprofessionals? How can we empower our support staff to use their talents in our schools in order to benefit all of our students? In order to do this, we need to provide paid professional development opportunities that are relevant for education support professionals. Our ESPs work with our students in every aspect possible throughout the entire school day. Yet we do not provide them with the training they need and deserve in order to benefit our students. We need to provide them with the training on our students' IEPs before they start the job. But instead, at times, we're putting them into a classroom the day they begin without any training, without any guidance or specific instructions needed to understand not only the abilities of the students they are working with, but the disabilities of the students. This is not only unacceptable, it can be unsafe for the students and the staff. How can we show ESPs they are valued as the professionals they are? Provide them with the resources they need to not only grow as a professional, but to feel valued and respected. Feeling invisible is one of the worst feelings in the world. We need to show our ESPs that they are seen, appreciated, heard, and valued. Our support staff contribute to the daily operations of a school, and they provide a whole child education for our students. We need to effectively utilize ESPs to maximize the ability of the students with IEPs so that the students have access to the grade level instruction in the least restrictive environment so they can be engaged with their peers and make progress not only academically but socially and emotionally. The amount of work that ESPs do requires an intensive amount of systemic support and planning. Providing 16 hours of paid annual training that is relevant to their position is valuable. We need to provide the opportunities to explore the student learning, to be active participants in data reporting, analysis processing, and to develop their ability to use evidence-based practices with fidelity. As we celebrate the efforts, we must also recognize that more work must be done to ensure that our ESPs are seen, protected, heard, and valued in our schools. They are the backbone of our educational system, and it's beyond time we provided them with the professional development relevant and necessary to their position. They are our most valuable resource, yet we provide them with the least amount of training. just like any position in the school district, whether you're an administrator, a teacher, or an ESP, we don't know what we don't know. It is our job to provide the skills and training they need and deserve in order to capitalize on the abilities of the students they're working with. They are not just helping with homework. They are reteaching lessons in an individualized manner. They are teaching life skills. They are with our most vulnerable students in a variety of settings. Our professional development needs to be as individualized as the students they are working with. It is time to treat them as the professionals that they are. I've said it before, and I will say it again and again. ESPs do not make my job as a special education teacher easy. Paraprofessionals make my job possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And I think finally we have here in person, Kim Kanukwa. Something like that. Please identify yourself and please proceed.
Chair and members, my name is Kim Kaniakua. I am a paraeducator in the Fridley School District and a member of SEIU Local 284. Too often in schools across Minnesota, paraeducators are asked to learn on the job how to support our most vulnerable students. We're thrown in without knowing all the unique needs of our kids, which creates an unsafe environment for us and our students. Just as importantly, it's impossible for us to support students to learn, grow, and become more independent if we don't know their goals and their education plan. Oftentimes, we don't even have time to read the IEPs. One of the students in my school has sight issues. They changed paras mid-year, and their new para didn't know how to help the student or even who to ask to get the support that they needed. I'm going to date myself a little, but when I started first working as a para, I answered an ad in the local newspaper. It was a long time ago. At that time, there was a lot of more students being identified on the autism spectrum, so we were trained on autism and how to support students on the spectrum. And while that training was really beneficial and important, not we needed to know that information. Now we need more information so we can best serve all of our students and meet the entire range of student needs. We need training in de-escalation strategies, trauma, equity, mental health, just to name a few. Additionally, due to the shutdowns from the pandemic, we are seeing an increase in challenging behaviors and many students are academically behind. If we had more training, it would allow us to be able to help meet the needs of all students and also just give the paras confidence to do their jobs. Our district, like many others, has staffing shortages, and we want to ensure that when we get people here in the building and they're hired, that they have the necessary tools to do their job so they not only can support students effectively, but also feel confident and want to stay in their role. Our union has fought hard to make sure that paras are included in our all-district trainings, which we have in our district before school starts, and it's really important and valuable, but it's not enough. This bill would allow paras to meet with the IEP teams to learn about our students' unique and individual needs before the beginning of the school year. IEPs are most effective when paras working with the student know the plan's goals and its objectives. This bill would also give the time before working with students to develop the skills and tools to best support the students. I had been a stay-at-home mom when I started working as a para 20 years ago. I fell in love and I never left. Our jobs are very difficult, but they're also the most rewarding. This small change will make a big difference in our lives and in the lives of our students. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, before we go to questions, can I testify as a para as well? There's some things I didn't put in my opening that my fellow paras just reminded me of.
All right. Chair, you a king.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to mention Ms. Kanakua brought up a really good point on the de-escalation techniques. When I first started as a para at a high school level, study hall, lunchroom, cafeteria, I had been given nonviolent CPI training. It's crisis prevention and intervention training. And it was probably the most valuable experience I ever had. That school district made the investment in that. But it's one of those trainings you kind of have to refresh every few years, because if you're not using the techniques all the time, you get a little rusty on it. But the next school I went to didn't have the money to do the updated on the training. So there's the discrepancies that you kind of have there. There also, I've been put into positions with, you know, students where they use a device to communicate, not being trained on the device so that they can't communicate all day. Having to work with kiddos when I was in early childhood, go toilet a child that has a feeding tube. I'm trying to figure out how to do that. So there's a lot of different vulnerabilities all of our students have, and it's not just students with special needs. There's a lot of training around mental health supports and understanding what a child has when they have a crisis, the trauma they're bringing into the classroom with them. So there's a lot more training that needs to be done to make sure paras can be the valuable valuable tools and valuable parts of the team. As the one testifier, Ms. Detloff, said, paras don't make her job easier. They just make her job possible. So I hope you kind of keep that in mind as we go into questions, which I'd love to hear because I'm always up for making the bill better. But thank you for indulging me on that a little bit.
Thank you. We'll go to first Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Chair Joachim for bringing this bill before us. Similar to the chair, my mom is also a para. She's been a para for 20 plus years, and I know how hard they work. But like the chair mentioned, the paras really do have to advocate for themselves, and often many paras don't have the time or the capacity to do so. So I appreciate you for bringing this bill before us.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Urdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, my wife worked many years as a para, so I'm well aware of the situations that you have and the needs and the importance that you the important role that you play. I do have a question, but actually, one of Ms. Detloff. She there?
Ms. Detloff.
Hi, Mr. Urdahl. How are you?
That's what I was waiting to hear.
I'm afraid if you're going to tell a story right now.
Well, Madam Chair, there was this girl in seventh grade. But we won't go into that. I think that I actually was there at the end of my career when you were starting yours as a para.
Yes, and you taught my dad, Ricky.
Oh, yes.
Remember?
Yes, I do. I'm not going to tell that story again, though.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Enough of my past history at New London Spicer. The question I have is, how is this going to be funded? Does this become part of the cross-subsidy? We're struggling with a problem there. What is the plan?
All right, and Chair Joachim, we know that we're policy and the funding, but we make policies around funding, so I think that is something that's of interest to this committee, too.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Strom has helped me with a kind of a formula of what to look like, how much it would cost to have paras funded for 16 hours. So it wouldn't be baked in anywhere into a cross, wouldn't be put into special ed, because frankly, when I was a para at the high school and I got the CPI training, I was not a special ed para. There's a lot of different ways paraprofessionals are used, and either just instructional assistance, working with kiddos with special needs, but there is a way that we can compensate for the training model that we'd be looking at. And Mr. Strom would be able to fill that in when we get to finance. But my intention is to make sure that it is funded.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation. I'll just conclude by saying that no one calls me Mr. Urdahl unless they were one of my students.
All right. Seeing no further discussion from the committee at this point, Representative Joachim renews her motion to re-refer House File 620 to the Committee on Education. Closing remarks, sorry.
No worries, Madam Chair. I did the same exact thing this morning, too. Our paraprofessionals, or ESPs as we know them too, are the folks in our schools who provide most of the direct services to students with disabilities, as well as supports for the entire student population. We trust ESPs with very important caretaking tasks. They need professional development to be successful with our students and in their careers, and we owe them at least the chance to receive that training. Training that will help them grow in their jobs, feel fulfilled, helped with retention, and maybe even make them excited to keep continuing on and becoming a teacher with our Grow Your Own programs. You've heard testimony about how important and effective that training is, and I sit before you with the personal experience of how valuable that training can be. As this bill moves forward, I will continue to work with our school districts on any concerns that they may have, and I thank members and ask for your support.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Joachim, for bringing this bill forward. Thank you, testifiers, for being with us today.
And probably most important, thank you for the work that you're doing right now and continue to do. We do value and, you know, want to support you. So thank you. With that, Representative Joaquin renews her motion to, now I will say the words, and thank you, the village that keeps this on track. We'll reuse the motion to re-refer House File 620 to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. With that, our bill is moving. All right. Well, we're staying on time, which I appreciate, committee. Our final bill will be House File 923 from Representative Bennett. And it's our intention to lay this bill over for further consideration or possible inclusion. So Representative Bennett, would you like to make a motion to move House File 923 before the committee to be laid over?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bennett. All right. So please introduce you need no introduction, but go ahead and for the record, please introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you. I am State Representative Peggy Bennett, District 23A. And I was so focused on, because I told you I'd keep this bill moving quickly, that I almost came up too soon earlier. So trying to uphold my promise to keep this short and sweet. But thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill and committee members for doing so as well. But I would just like to first take the opportunity to just thank these some organizations that this legislation was brought forward by, and I'd like to just read those off. We have MnDependent, we have Minnesota Catholic Conference, Jewish Community Relations Council, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Association of Christian Schools International, Catholic Schools Center of Excellence, AIM Higher Foundation, and Catholic Community Foundation. So many different groups behind this request here. And House File 923, basically just clarifies in law more flexibility between non-public schools and school districts regarding transportation services. And during the Safe Learning Plan, when we were under the peacetime emergency order, the things that are in this bill were allowed. And once that emergency order was lifted, there was questions on whether school districts and non-public schools could continue with the agreements that they had. This is something that was mutually decided upon between both groups. So what this bill does is just clarify in language pretty much what they were doing during those peacetime, that Safe Learning Plan, because it was working really well. So I'm going to just stop right there. I do have one testifier. Her name is Meg Forgette. I got your name correctly, and I'm going to let her speak to this a bit, Madam Chair, if that's okay.
Yes, please proceed, Ms. Forgette, and identify yourself again for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Meg Forgette, and I am the Government Programs and Community Engagement Specialist in the Department of Catholic Schools for the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. I'm here to testify in support of House File 923. My leadership role in the Archdiocese involves supporting our Catholic school leadership, covering 91 Catholic schools throughout the 12-county metro area, serving over 30,000 pre-K through 12th grade students, and representing over 40% of the non-public students in our state. I support our leaders in understanding and accessing government programming and funds available to our non-public students, while also supporting collaborative efforts to work with our public school districts in meeting the needs of all of our students. Transportation in particular has been an area of service over the past few years where flexibility and creativity has been needed more than ever for various reasons. Two growing challenges in particular, changing route times, as well as diminishing transportation resources, have significantly impacted many students' abilities to get to school. I want to provide you with two concrete examples to illustrate how these challenges are playing out here in Minnesota. The first challenge I mentioned, changing route times, often do not align with school start and end times. One of our Minneapolis schools was already beginning their school day at 9:55 a.m. and ending at 4:20 to accommodate the transportation needs of other schools in that district. The school, however, was told in the midst of their school year that their pickup time was going to be pushed back later by up to an hour. for their students after their school day was ending. While our dedicated educators put in extended hours to support and care for the students, this challenge also led to students getting home much later and having less time with families before needing to prepare for and rest up for the next day. The second challenge I mentioned, diminishing resources and transportation, has also negatively impacted students' abilities to get to school. It's no secret that there's a shortage of workers in the field of transportation, including school bus drivers. Another Catholic school in our archdiocese has needed further flexibility and creativity to collaborate with their public school district. Yet with driver shortages and tight funding, there hasn't been further consideration or creativity given to meet these growing transportation needs currently. While many students attending this non-public school may fall within the public school district's boundaries, the majority do not fall within the limited distances from their neighboring schools required for them to actually receive busing at all. I spoke with a grandmother from this school. Her apartment, where she was caring for multiple grandchildren, no longer fell within the boundaries of their resident public school. She also needed to work full-time during the day at the age of 86 to support her family. She was in tears, faced with the reality that her sixth grader might no longer be able to attend the school she had been and that had done so much to support her family over the past several years, all due to transportation. Although this Catholic school has been doing all it can to be creative in trying to support and coordinate other transportation possibilities for many of their families, the reality is that they simply cannot do it for all of their families. This bill would support potential solutions to tough, real challenges such as this one. As I've mentioned, changing route times and diminishing resources within the school transportation field overall have significantly limited many students' abilities simply to get to school. This bill would allow school leaders the flexibility and creativity to overcome these challenges in many more situations. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you. And just to add to that again with this bill, it doesn't tell school districts or non-public schools what to do. It just allows them that flexibility if they would mutually agree to lots of unique ideas that can solve problems, and that's what we like to see with local control. So I just wanted to add that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. If I may address a question specifically. So as you explained it, it's clarifying language to say that, yes, non-public schools and public schools can enter into these contracts together. Are there public state dollars that follow and support the transportation, or is that part of what we're clarifying also or not?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are no changes in funding in this bill. It's pure policy. Currently, public school districts are required, and they're paid for it, to transport non-public children that live within their district. This doesn't change that. It only changes opportunity for mutual agreements to happen amongst those school districts. The funding part remains the same as is in current law.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, and I'm probably not, really getting the nuance of what we're saying. It sounds like this could be happening right now. I mean, it has been happening, and it was clear that it could work when we were, returning safely to school during that transition period. So it could still be happening, and what this bill is just reinforcing that the opportunity is there and just supporting. But I'm not. Is there something, a language that say that we are removing or adding? That would be a barrier if we didn't do this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the barrier is, I guess, confusion, because again, during that those emergency orders, this was allowed. And then when it quit, there was a lot of confusion, like, can we keep with these mutual agreements? They were working well. And so districts need this clarification so they can be sure to continue this.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for answering my questions. And any other comments and questions from members? And yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like more clarity on what these would look like. I'm thinking of my own kids. I've got an elementary school and a middle schooler, and their start times are like dramatically different. And I know that that's in part because they're trying to like figure out the school bus schedule and how to get all the kids to all the places. And so I'm just curious what these agreements would look like, and would it basically just allow us to like puzzle piece in the non-public transportation amongst all the other transportation And maybe you could describe what it was looking like during the pandemic and how we want it to continue to look.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Feist. And will that, Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can make a bit of a comment, but you might have some additional comments. But I know even in my own local schools, we have a number of non-public schools. And, of course, with the pandemic, a lot of changes were made with the school day. Non-public schools were meeting, public schools weren't. There were a lot of issues. And so in some cases, a school district can allow the non-public school to have, I believe anyway here, to have a contract with the bus company and still mutually agree the funding that would have been there anyway for that, if I'm describing this correctly. Other options are actually that already in law where school districts can give parents vouchers to provide transportation. And some of these flexibilities were happening during that time. And I'm going to maybe let our testifier add more clarity to that part.
I was going to say you read my mind. One of the key examples that I think of is we do have some non-public schools and Catholic schools that I work directly with every day that for whatever their different reasons might be, they might not need necessarily a bus, or for some reason it fits their students better, where maybe they've come to the conclusion that they might not need transportation 1 year, and so maybe doing something like, you know, small voucher of what their dollars would be, allowing the very limited buses that the district might have in general to be freed up for some of the public schools or other schools. So as far as when you're talking about, you know, putting the puzzle together and fitting all those pieces together, having that flexibility can make a big difference. And, you know, in that example, it's the non-public who might be set on their busing, but other times it's reversed. I think what I've seen, again, 91 Catholic schools, 49 different school districts, there's just a lot of variability. And so that flexibility and creativity for schools to be able to mutually work together, that's huge. And it sounds so simple, but there's such a variety of different situations that come up. Again, just having that being able to have that flexibility and creativity to fit the individual situation really benefits all students. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Fikes, and then we'll return to Representative Baker.
Thanks. I just want to get clarification then. So it wouldn't necessarily be buses. So when you talk about vouchers, I assume it's not for like Uber. Is it like for like minivans or for gas price or?
No, usually at least what I was speaking to is parent transportation. So the parent is driving the student.
And Representative Feist?
And so the district school is paying for time, for the parents' time to provide transportation to their child to get to school, or for like reimbursing them for gas?
Or Ms. Furzett?
My understanding of it has been that it is the very limited, it's a very small amount, but the limited dollars that would have gone to that school in agreement with the school district to not utilize the busing specifically, it's going to pay for, I guess I can't say for certain if it's gas or the vehicle itself, but it's parents driving, parents making the decision and being okay with driving their students to school instead of being bused as the district would typically.
Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair, thank you. And just to help clarify, Representative Feist, so this bill does not change anything with vouchers or payments or anything like that. In current law right now, school districts are responsible to transport students within their district to whatever school, whether they go to a non-public school or a public school. And those districts do it in different ways. Most of them do it within their regular bus routes, and they pick up kids and add time on those routes. It's just something that currently law expects, and school districts are reimbursed for that. Occasionally, a district will say, you know what, we're just not able to do this with the number of bus drivers we have and buses, so we're going to provide parents vouchers, you know, those that live in the country, just like a public school student who lives in the country and should get bus service, but they can't, they can provide then a voucher for that parent to cover that. This bill does not really do that. I'm just naming that, adding that this flexibility is something that's mutual between the school districts and the non-public schools. And if they both say, hey, this is going to work well for us, it allows flexibility for them to continue and create a contract to get students to school. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helped, but try to explain.
I appreciate, I think we're trying to get clarity about what this is, and mm-hmm. also knowing that this is being laid over, and if we need further clarity, that we can follow up with more discussion too, that we don't have to, because sometimes you do have to have it explained and get a different situation brought up and understood better. And I'm turning to Representative Baker.
Yeah, I'll make it quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bennett. I think it's just from a kind of a nuts and bolts standpoint. So we have a non-public in my district, and our transportation director works with the principal of that non-public, meets with us as an administrative team at the public school, and we work out the routes to make it work. So I think it's like Representative Bennett said, it's not a burden on the district, and there is. The financial side is completely separate than this. So mm-hmm. No one has to worry about vouchers. Vouchers aren't happening. So, but I think what it does is it provides a really strong connection within the community and shows that as a school district, we are working together to make sure kids get to school wherever they choose to go. So this has this would provide clarity for us. And I think this is just a common sense bill, so.
All right, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bennett. I just have a couple questions because transportation, obviously, like we have to get kids to school no matter what educational setting they choose. I just wanna make sure, so in my district, we provide all the special education services for our St. Joe's private school. So I just wanna make sure that this is providing the same opportunity if a parent chooses, because right now with the busing issues, we're having a hard time getting students from our private school to our public school for like their speech therapy that they need to do or some of those services that we provide through the public school. So I just wanna make sure as I read it, I feel like we're not missing that, but that this is also an opportunity if parents want to transport their kids in the middle of the day for those support services. I just want to make sure we're not missing that piece of the transportation need as well, that this isn't just for getting to school and getting to home, but it's also those in-between stops in the day.
All right, Representative
Thank you,
Bennett.
Madam Chair. And you are correct, Representative Keeler. This just a mutually agreed written plan for transportation, whether during the day, before, after, it provides for all of that.
Representative Keeler, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bennett. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't missing that piece because that's really important. The other thing that I want to ask is around liability, that we also know that there's like parent partnerships that are like, if I'm going to caravan my kid to school, maybe that apartment complex or individuals in that neighborhood. My district, because of lack of transportation, now moved out to a 2-mile radius that you have to, like, that's a long ways for first graders to be walking. But the barrier that we're seeing around parent transportation is that if I'm a parent and I want to bring Representative Frazier's kid with me, now there's a liability issue with transporting kids to school. Does this address the liability piece at all, or is that something that maybe we can work offline to make sure that we're, because, like, as a liaison, I couldn't transport kids because of the liability piece that is only covered in school buses.
Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair, thank you. You know, Representative Keeler, to my knowledge, this doesn't change any liability laws or allow any other additional types of transportation that are already currently allowed in law. So all this does is allow school districts to work, public schools to work with non-private and contract, allow, say, the non-public to contract directly with the bus company instead of having to circumvent through a lot of different means. So it's not going to change any liability laws that are already in place. Those are still in place.
That's it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Keeler is very interested in this bill. And she's everything that affects students. This is, and we appreciate the discussion and your answers. And we are up against time. Representative Lee, did you have another question that we probably could slide in one more?
Yeah, very quickly, Madam Chair. I wanted to just elevate what Representative Feist was saying about the transportation issues. I cannot sit here and not mention that St. Paul has had a variety of transportation issues with our students in high school. So our school district has started using city buses to transport students, and that's become a safety issue. And so would appreciate further discussion and this understanding the bill will be laid over for further consideration.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Lee. All right. Thank you, Representative Bennett, for bringing this forward and sparking some very animated discussion and interest in this interest of all kids getting to school safely and everything else in between during the day. And with that, we'll renew the motion to lay over the bill. And thank you, Representative Bennett.
Thank you.
All right. And I'm sorry, I did not give you an opportunity for closing remarks, but I think we did an excellent discussion and appreciate that. All right, and we are up against our time limit now, so our meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.